So I wanted to read from Me Talk Pretty One Day, where David Sedaris is talking about, in French, everything is gendered, so it's masculine or feminine. And he says, I just can't manage to keep my stories straight. Hoping I might learn through repetition, I tried using gender in my everyday English. Hi, guys, I'd say, opening a new box of paper clips, or, hey, Hugh, have you seen my belt? I can't find her anywhere. I invented personalities for the objects on my dresser and set them up on blind dates. When things didn't work out with my wallet, my watch drove a wedge between my hairbrush and my lighter. The scenarios reminded me of my youth, when my sisters and I would enact epic dramas with our food. Ketchup-wigged French fries would march across our plates, engaging in brief affairs or heated disputes over carrot coins, while burly chicken legs guarded the perimeter, ready to jump in should things get out of hand. Sexes were assigned at our discretion and were subject to change from one night to the next. Unlike here, where the corn cob and the string bean remain locked in their rigid masculine roles. Say what you like about Southern social structure, but at least in North Carolina, a hot dog is free to swing both ways.
Your shelf for mine, talking sophisticated topics all the time. Your shelf for mine, a kick back, relax, crack a book, unwind at your shelf for mine. Your shelf or mine.
Hello, and welcome to Your Shelf
or Mine.
Or Mine.
I'm Austin Brigden, Circulation Specialist here at the Longview Public Library.
And I'm Jacob Collins, Library Technician and Youth Services at the Longview Public Library.
And I'm Joe Dallas, Programming Technician at the Longview Public Library.
Hi, guys.
Howdy.
Hello.
Something feels weird about today, like we're missing something. It's Becky.
Oh.
You'd be the one to notice.
It's just the three of us today to talk about David Sedaris. A lot of times how we start out is by going around and talking about what our background is, what we're bringing to it this time. So, Joe, do you want to start with yours?
Sure. I think I first became aware of David Sedaris in the 2000s. I think I was listening to NPR and he came on reading about Crumpet the Elf. And I thought that was so funny. And so we bought the book and read all of the Holidays on Ice. And then when Me Talk Pretty One Day, my husband bought the audio version and we were listening to it while we were traveling somewhere. And I remember having to pull off the road because I was laughing so hard. I couldn't see. I was crying and I was trying to drive. So I had a near accident listening to Me Talk Pretty One Day.
Wow. Jacob?
I have no experience with David Sedaris at all. I had no idea who he was or had never heard of him. I had heard of his sister, Amy Sedaris, and she had voiced Princess Carolyn in BoJack Horseman. So the last name Sedaris was like, that was my, all that I knew about him. I'd known nothing else. So I went into it a blank slate.
Nice. I've known about David Sedaris for a long time. My dad is a diehard NPR listener in my childhood. So we would always be listening to NPR. And so he was on This American Life a lot at that point. And so he's just one, a voice out of my childhood. I think my dad was working like graveyard shift at the mill and started and was listening to whatever radio show that the Holidays on Ice, the elf stories where he's working as a Christmas elf at like Gimbel's were playing. And so he had always been a fan. So I kind of grew up hearing him and we recently went to see him. But I can talk more about that later.
So David Sedaris is very funny to a lot of people. And I was wondering, what is one of the funniest stories that's made you chuckle the most that you've read or that you've listened to of his? Anything stand out?
Oh my gosh, there's so many. So I guess for people at home who might not know David Sedaris, he writes primarily essays. I think as he's gone on, he writes more. He used to do more kind of weird little fiction things, but he does mostly essays about himself and his family. We were just talking about one of the recent ones. I can't remember if it was in Happy Go Lucky, which is his most recent, or Calypso, which was the one before that. He gets like a fatty tumor, and the French doctor is very dismissive about it. It's like dogs get him all the time. But he gets this idea that he really wants to have his tumor removed and feed it to a snapping turtle, because they go all the time to the Emerald Island off of the North Carolina coast. And he has a beach house there called the C-section. And he like goes and he goes to his doctor. He's like an English doctor then, I think, who he's asking, has like no personality, he says. And he wants him to remove the tumor and give it to him. And he's like, oh, I can't do that. It's against the law. I think it might have been an American doctor. And so what ends up happening is he's like telling the story at one of his readings. And this woman is like, I can do it for you. I can do it tonight. And he's like, okay. So he like goes with this woman to like, some, you know, like her house. And she's like a nurse or something. And she agrees to remove the tumor and give it to him. So he puts it in the freezer and saves it for this certain snapping turtle that has a big growth on its head that they call like granddaddy. It's just, but there's no shortage of those moments.
Yeah. So this is my, like I said, it was my first experience reading David Sedaris. And normally I'm not someone who reads like humorous works. Like if I'm going to engage with something that's funny, I tend to do it with like stand up or with something that has like an audio visual component. So like in the medium of like essay or fiction or anything, it's not something that I typically engage with. But when I was reading David Sedaris, I found myself sitting alone in my house just reading this and laughing maniacally at a lot of the different things that he had written. And the one in particular that got me was Front Row Center with Thaddeus Bristol, which was this, it seems like the character is like a reviewer of like Broadway musicals or Broadway works. And he's critiquing the efforts and plays of these like school age children. And he's getting really into the criticisms of them and personal attacks on them and talking about the lack of quality and depth and like the writing and the characters. And it's just so hilarious. Like this character's so mean and lacks any sense of self-awareness at all. And there's like a line at the end of it where he's like, maybe I'm missing something.
What about you, Joe?
So for me, what really got me, being from Canada, and we had to take French since kindergarten, and just the when he talks in Me Talk Pretty One Day about trying to learn the language, that's what really got me, because a lot of it is so true. You could be such an eloquent person in real life, but when you're trying to learn a language and all you are left with is these little phrases that you've learned to try to express ideas. And his teacher that he talks about was so militant and would make fun of them all the time. And I definitely had French teachers like that growing up. But so I wrote down a little bit from it. It was huddled in the smoky hallways and making the most of our pathetic French. My fellow students and I engaged in the sort of conversation commonly overheard in refugee camps. Sometimes me cry alone at night. That is common for me also, but be more strong, you. Much work, and someday you talk pretty. People stop hate you soon. Maybe tomorrow, okay? I don't know. I could just so relate to that.
Yeah. Those are hilarious. I reread, there's one in the, he has like a The Best of Me, and it's called Jesus Shaves, and it's about East, well, it's about like holidays. They're doing like an exercise about holidays. And there's this one like really smug Jamaican woman who already knows French, but she doesn't know what Easter is. And so then they're all trying to tell her what it is in this like terrible French. Like they start going around trying to tell them. And there's these two Polish ladies who are like, it is, said one, a party for the little boy of God who call himself Jesus. And oh shit, she faltered and her fellow countrymen came to her aid. He call himself Jesus, and then he die one day on two morsels of lumber. And then the rest of the class jumped in, offering bits of information that would have given the Pope an aneurysm. He die one day, and then he go above my head to live with your father. He weared of himself the long hair, and after he die, the first day he come back here for to say hello to the peoples. He nice, the Jesus.
And then there was the flying bell.
The fly, yeah. Yeah, they don't have, he starts talking about the Easter Bunny, and the teacher's like, no, no, no. Here, a flying bell comes from Rome and delivers the chocolate. He's like, what?
He's like, at least the bunny is something that you could imagine traveling and going around.
Like, yeah, he's like, the bunny has eyes. Like, how does the bell know where to go? I don't know. He has a really funny one called 6 to 8 Black Men, too, that's about, like, Christmas traditions. I think it's the Netherlands that have the 6 to 8 Black Men who will, like, come and, like, beat you up, I think.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
Some European traditions are a little bit scary.
You're very scary.
What's the German?
Was one? That Krampus?
Krampus? Yeah, that's right.
Where he'll, like, stuff you in a sack and, like, throw you around or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Ours don't really have that element of danger.
You just get a lump of coal and that's it.
Yeah.
Another one that I really liked was the Crumpet the Elf on Holidays on Ice, when he talks about being a Santaland elf. And it's just, if you've ever worked in public service, I think you can really relate to sometimes seeing the worst of people. And so I love that when he starts to, the mother wants the little girl to sit, or it might be a little boy, to sit on Santa's lap, and she's trying to make her say, no one, Santa's not going to bring you any toys. Yeah, and then David goes, yeah, he's going to come into your house. He's going to take all your clothes, all your towels. And then the woman goes, I'm going to have you fired. And he goes, I'm going to have you killed.
Oh, no.
Just those little things you wish you could say sometimes, but yeah, you'll hold yourself back.
Yeah.
I saw a meme a while ago that was like, there should be like one holiday where like every single retail person or person who works in customer service should just be able to say whatever they want without consequence.
Oh,
like I'm holding that out for that.
Oh, man. Wow. One of the things in David Sedaris's work is you get to know, for anybody who hasn't read it, you're going to get to know his family over the course of all these essays. So his boyfriend, Hugh, and his dad, Lou, and his mom, who's Sharon, who's like passed away in like the 90s. She's often like remembering her. She's not, you know, or she's in sort of flashbacks to his childhood. And then his siblings. I mean, one of the funny things I remember, his siblings are also weird. Amy Sedaris gets written about a lot. Like Gretchen, who's the one sister, she like works as a horticulturalist. But there's an essay where she's like eating in her sleep. I don't know if you guys read that one, but she tells about, it happened, she has birds too. And one day in her sleep, she like eats this thing she had for her bird, which was basically like a loaf of condensed flies, like that had been, you know, pressed together. And she wakes up and she's like, God, there's like a plate with a few flies left on it.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And one day they're like all together for Thanksgiving. And a lot of the essays, they're like, all the siblings will get together. And she comes out in the middle of the night and like just starts pulling like wings and different things off the turkey and just like eating them, and doesn't say anything to Hugh and David. They're like sitting there.
It reminds me of a little bit of Yellow Jackets or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the dog disappears.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Yeah, there's no spoilers here. We can say whatever we want.
It's interesting to see how he talks about his relationship with his dad as the books progress, like as he gets later in life. It seems like the earlier ones, his dad is more just like a comical character. And then later on, you can see he's really been hurt by his dad. Yeah.
Oh, his dad is, yeah, crazy.
Something else.
You're a big fat zero. That's like what his dad says to him all the time. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and there's this part where David gets into swimming and he's like trying his best, and there's this other kid, and I can't remember the kid's name, but it's like he would constantly talk about how great this other kid was.
Yeah.
And would just say, you know, that he's destined for the Olympics. And he would talk about him every evening after the swim meets. On the ride home, he would go over to the kid's family and, like, talk him up. And, like, talk about how he was destined for greatness. And this, like, ends up pushing David to try and beat this kid. And he manages to do it. And rather than his dad, like, congratulating him or, like, treating him as if he accomplished something, he's just like, you beat him, like, one time out of 50. It's no big deal. You got lucky.
Oh, his dad will never, like... he's like, and he becomes obviously this, you know, rich and famous writer. Somewhere he talks about the first time his book was like on the New York Times bestseller list. And he's like, Dad. And he's like, well, I didn't see it. It wasn't on the Wall Street Journal best books list. He's like, nobody looks at the Wall Street Journal best books list. And the dad's like, I do.
I heard in an interview where he was talking about his dad during COVID, he was put in a home. And I think he had like an almost near-death experience, but then he recovered. And because no one could visit him, David said that he was writing him these long letters. And he was talking on the phone to him, and David asked, did you get my letters? And he was so dismissive about it. He goes, yeah, you didn't say very much. And he was like, well, who's writing you letters? Like, only I'm the only one writing you letters. But he did say that towards the end, he was put in a room and he didn't understand how to work the TV. So for maybe once in his life, he wasn't surrounded by the conservative news media and he wasn't listening to all that and getting all upset about stuff. So he said that towards the end, he forgot. And I think he might have had dementia too. He said he forgot that he was a bad guy. Like, he was much changed towards the end.
Yeah. I think it's kind of an amazing thing now that Sedaris has been writing these for 30 plus years about these same characters. You really get a relationship with these characters over time, especially if you've been reading the books as they've come out over the last decades. And it's been interesting to see as time goes on and he's dealing with different stuff. Like, the early essays are about, you know, what his childhood, but it also being young and having no money and taking these crazy jobs and stuff. And now he's dealing with, his sister committing suicide, his father dying, him and Hugh and their sort of aging. And yeah, it's interesting to see
which sibling was the one that passed away.
Tiffany.
Mm-hmm.
And she would come up in the earlier essays. She wasn't like somebody he wrote about a lot, because he writes a lot about Amy, because they're like the closest, maybe, and Gretchen and Lisa.
And he has a brother, doesn't he?
Oh, and Paul. Yeah. The rooster.
The rooster. Oh, man.
There's some essays I cannot read on this podcast just because the density of profanity, but they're great. Oh, and if you listen to David Sedaris is such a good reader of his own work. Like, if you listen to him, there's a famous one that sort of introduces this whole rooster thing called You Can't Kill the Rooster. And if you listen to him read that one, it is just hilarious. There's just so many.
And I think it's so funny how his dad is just so like blasé about the attitude and the word choice, just the way that the rooster speaks. And it's he just treats it like it's normal.
Yeah.
And if anything, he seems more accepting of like the rooster's behavior than of David in general.
Yes. Yeah. And the family is like, so his dad's like an IBM engineer and they move from New York like when they're kids. But I think Paul was the only one born in North Carolina. And so he's like totally North Carolina, has talks with the accent, and his dad just seems to accept it. Yeah, I'm struggling to quote from the essay because I can't, but yeah, it's really funny. And now in his essays, he's getting into like another generation, because like Paul's kid, he's interacting a lot with his nephews and nieces and stuff. He's usually frustrated with them because they don't care about anything. Yeah, I think it's really interesting too, the way I was telling Becky, dealt with success, because I think some people he definitely writes out of his own like adversity and difficulties and stuff, and gets a lot of the fuel for his, especially his early essays. And then he became wildly successful and rich, and some people aren't able to like keep going, or they get boring, or they get sort of like, I don't know, people change. And he's managed to stay sort of funny and self-aware and everything, even after being successful, found different ways of getting material.
I think in the introduction to The Best of Me, he talks a little bit about that and how a lot of his early work is dedicated to larger subjects like family and individual people and then like kind of society in general. And as he's gotten older, he's sort of narrowed his focus down into smaller little key moments. He would try to just write about like the most insignificant thing possible as like a challenge. And he talks about the challenge of being successful and like having to duplicate or, you know, create more work, even when you've already at that point of success where you've already reached that high level of fame. And like, what's next? Like, what's the next thing that you can possibly do to basically top yourself?
I've also heard him say in interviews that he enjoys the public appearances and he enjoys the live audiences and going on talk shows. And he said that now that's his reward for writing is to, and he was saying during COVID, he would get his, he would ask his partner, Hugh, when I enter the room, could you just applaud for me, please?
Him and Hugh are great. They have such a funny relationship. But yeah, he tours so much. Like, it's a punishing schedule that he does. And then he does, like, we saw, have either of you seen, did you ever see him appear anywhere? He appears pretty regularly, but we went and saw him in Astoria. We were kind of surprised he was at the Liberty Theater there. And I knew he has, like, a reputation. I was terrified to be in the signing line because he has kind of a reputation for asking, like, strange and unexpected questions of the signing line people. He'll also stay until the last person signs. So the first time he was at the Liberty Theater, I think they were there until 1 a.m. But we got in line and waited and chatted. And you get up to him and he's, like, sitting at this table and he had, I don't know, like, 50 Sharpies of different colors spread all over the table. As he starts talking to us, he starts, like, doodling in our book, which I have. And it has, like, all these tulips in it. And he's talking to us and stuff. And then we didn't realize, we're so relieved to, like, talk to him and not embarrass ourselves, that we get outside and we're walking down the street back to our car in Astoria, and we realize they didn't sign it. He forgot to sign it. So it says to Austin and Becky, and then it's got some nice little, nice little tulips doodled on the page. But he asked us I don't remember what all, he asked us like who our oldest friend was. And then he started telling the story. We said we were going to be married. And he said, oh, he was like, there was this couple in one of his signing lines who were going to be married. And they were both grad students and they had no money. So he decided to send them on a honeymoon to Paris, like all expenses paid. And flights, everything, the hotel for 10 days in Paris and all this stuff. And he goes, you know, they didn't even send a thank you card.
Wow.
We were like, whoa.
I read someone reviewing Me Talk Pretty one day and saying that his mom had gone to one of his talks to get a book signed for him. And this guy was also gay, was also living in France. And he said is when it ended, his mom jumps up and goes, oh, Mr. Sedaris, you got to sign my book. My son's also gay and he also lives in France. And I guess what he did, he told her, yeah, wait your turn. And he had every row go and saved this woman's row for the very last. And he said the mom was so embarrassed she could feel the hatred of all the other people radiating.
He's kind of scary. I don't know.
But in that situation, I'd be like, yeah.
He told a story, too, about some lady who insisted on going ahead of a bunch of other people. I think he wrote in her book, you're a horrible person or something. I don't know. He's like... He's had like different themes. Like he used to give out condoms when he did readings. I don't know. He gives out different things. His wardrobe is like a big thing about him now. Yeah. He buys the weirdest clothes. What are those called?
The gauchos or culottes.
Culottes. Yeah. He loves culottes. And Hugh's like, why are you dressing like that? Why are you dressing like this?
I saw him on Colbert and he was dressed. It was so interesting. He had on like nice pants and he was playing with different colors and he had a regular suit jacket, but sewn into the suit jacket was this like a plaid shirt. So it looked like he had a shirt tied around his waist, but it was actually sewn into the suit jacket. So it was flowing down. And it was for what was the book that had the clown on the cover?
That's Happy Go Lucky. That's the most recent one.
Yeah. And he was saying that. He goes, well, I figured I had a clown on the cover of my book so I could play with what I was wearing.
Was that the interview where he talks about how like he hates ghosts?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's the same one. Yeah. Or people that believe in ghosts. Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
I had Becky listening to some, I think it was from Let's Discuss Diabetes with Owls, and he was like, he had decided that he was going to get a taxidermied owl for Hugh for Valentine's Day. He had asked, his request to Hugh for Valentine's Day was a 18th century anatomical model of the human throat. That's what he wanted but he decided instead of getting Hugh chocolates, he would get him a taxidermied owl, which you can't get in the United States because it's illegal. and it's also illegal in France, and but in England apparently you can get it. And he ends up in this taxidermy shop, and the guy, he's like, the guy sees something in him and like takes him to the back where he has like a mummified human arm that was like cut off in a bar fight, has like a tattoo on it and everything that his grandfather had mummified. And he shows him like a shrunken head and shows him all of this stuff, you know, and it's for sale too, but like, hush, hush. And he's like, what did this guy see in me? And then he goes, he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right.
I like his, he has a lot of sarcasm for American tourists, which being Canadian, I like that a lot. And he was saying that when he was living in Paris, that American tourists would be dressed with the t-shirts and the shorts and looks like they're coming to Europe to mow its lawns.
He has the trash collecting thing. That's another thing he does. He got really into like collecting trash by the roadside in Normandy, or not Normandy, I mean where they live now in England, in Sussex. And they named a trap. They have like a David Sedaris trash track.
Oh, that's track, right. I remember that.
Because he picks up so much trash.
Yeah, I saw an interview where he got a Fitbit.
It became
like an obsession with him, where he had a friend in the U.S. and that he would have competitions with her where who could get the most steps. So he said he would start at midnight, like just when the Fitbit would reset, and just walk miles and miles and to see who could get the most steps for that day.
He's insane about the Fitbit essays. It's like a slave. He calls himself a slave to the Fitbit, and then it breaks at one point, and he has like this blissful, like, I'm free. And then he can't stand it, and he orders another one next day delivery.
Yeah, I can kind of relate to that a little bit.
And Hugh's kind of the straight man to a lot of his, I don't know, I feel like he makes fun of Hugh more than he used to, but like Hugh's kind of the straight man, like looking at him and being like, why? What are you doing this for? And Amy, did you guys read any of the essays about Amy?
I have, yeah, in the past.
A few of them, yeah.
She kind of matches him for zaniness.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And she's really into the shopping, too. She has a second apartment so she can get away from her rabbits. Because she has, like, rabbits free-ranging in one of her New York apartments. And then they go shopping together, like, especially in Japan. They love to go shopping in Japan. They go to this one shop where all the clothes are, like, distressed to look like they came off, like, homicide victims. And so they buy clothes there. Just the weirdest stuff.
Yeah, he was saying he'll go up to Amy's apartment and it could be like 10 at night and she'll pretend that she's a real estate person. It's going, now I'm going to show you this apartment. I really shouldn't be showing you this apartment this late at night, but here, and she'll show him around. And yeah, she's pretty kooky. She'd be real fun, I think, to hang out with.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a fun interview where David and Amy go on the Drew Barrymore show and they get interviewed together. And it's really good. It was apparently like their first public appearance at the interview together. So it's really fun to see them like play off of each other. And you get to see like a glimpse into their relationship.
Yeah. I'll have to find that. Yeah. They seem like their humor is very matched.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
On Holidays on Ice, he talks about one of his early jobs being the elf in Santa Land. And so I was wondering, do you guys have any stories about early jobs, bad early jobs? Probably not as good as being an elf in Santa Land.
Well, working at a public library.
Yeah. You could write some essays about things that happen at the public library, but I've never been an elf.
When I was 20, I was in Canada. They have or had a program where students could work at the border and be border guards. And you had to do like this 2-week training. And then, they just sent you out there and we were letting people into Canada and stuff and doing customs stuff and doing searches, trying to catch people smuggling. Yeah, I was 20 years old.
That seems like a big job.
This was before 9/11. So I don't know if they're still doing it. But yeah, before 9/11, I was waiting. And it was a big competition in the office to see who could catch people for smuggling, and I never caught.
You never busted anybody?
Anybody. And I would try my hardest, I'm sure much to the chagrin of all the tourists and Canadians returning. I remember one time a guy pulled up on his motorcycle, and you have questions you have to ask, and one of them is, do you have any weapons? And he said he had a gun in his compartment of his motorcycle. And I said, well, you can't bring that into Canada. And he said, okay. And he turned around, and then he came back like an hour later and wanting to come in. And I said, well, do you have your gun? And he told me that, no, he buried it in the woods. So
what? Yeah, oh, my God. Wow. Well, that's wow. Yeah. I don't have anything quite like that. I was a dishwasher at a Boy Scout camp for a while, and that was kind of an intense job.
That is an intense job. I got hired on at this hotel in Marina and as a dishwasher, and they moved me within a week because I was too slow.
It was insane. I remember it was like a big old dining hall, and there was like a little window where the dishes would, you know, when it was time to do the dishes, there's this whole routine, and the boys would have to like get up and bring the dishes, and they would say, okay, and they gave some signal, and I'd be on the other side of this window, and dishes would just start like, and the, yeah. they'd like shoving them, you know, and so like piles of things are falling on me, and I'm like trying to move really fast, and had one of those big sanitizers, yeah. you know, and I learned a lot of music that I didn't know before.
Yeah.
With like, they were blasting like Irish drinking songs mostly.
Oh, yeah.
And Tom Petty. I don't think I'd listen to Tom Petty. And what other weird, there was like weird stuff we would listen to, but mainly Irish drinking songs.
I would get yelled at by the cooks because they would need a pan or something. And I was trying to get all the food off of it, but I just wasn't fast enough.
The dishwasher, there was like people would pick on the dishwashers too. And like the chef, he was this beady eyed little guy. And one day I remember kind of like joking, but like we were like talked back to him or something. And so he took maple syrup and he like poured it all over these sheet pans. And then he put them in the oven and baked it on.
Oh, man.
And there was this other cook who like slept in the dry goods supply closet because they had these big shelves. And he just used that as like a bunk. And he would go back and sleep in there all the time. And I remember this other guy, it was this manic little guy who was like the steward. And so he kind of managed everything. And he was kind of maniacally trying to catch mice because they had these big rafters in this building. And he said at night he would go out and they were like little mouse highways. You could watch the mice running along the rafters. It was crazy. Yeah, it was crazy.
I think I've heard other people that have worked in kitchens. And I think it is a big... It's a big culture, you know, like the kitchen culture with the, yeah.
My other jobs have been considerably less interesting, but I did work at a coal fire plant for a little bit, and I got to know a lot of people from differing perspectives, I'll say. It's a very, like, very blue-collar, red, very conservative-leaning people. And so going in as like this like newly like discovered gay guy, it was very interesting. I was not very well accepted there, but also it was just everyone was so obsessed with this like toxic work culture of like you're going to work yourself to the bone for the man. And that's cool.
Oh. cool.
And if you don't do that, then it's like then you're just a freeloader. And so it was very interesting. I got to meet a lot of different people. One of the guys that I worked with, he was our foreman. He would brag constantly about how much harder he worked than everyone else, like how much more valuable to the company he was than everyone else. And then come to find out, he had been spotted working late at night past when he was supposed to be there.
Oh.
And they were wondering, like, is he just trying to get overtime, like, you know, work 100 hours a week or whatever to just get paid more? Turns out he had been there at night to steal stuff, and he'd been stealing tools, he'd been all this stuff, and they finally caught him on camera loading his truck with like $100,000 worth of copper wire.
Oh wow.
And he only got busted because they saw him on camera. Like people saw him off shift, they're like, hey, what, you work day shift, you shouldn't be here, swing or graveyard. Like
what a wow. It was all a ruse.
Yeah, right. And wow. my other job was as a security guard. And really the only, I wasn't there very long. It was only for like 2 months. But the one interesting thing that happened there was one day my partner was basically like, be careful. And I was like, I'm a security guard. There's nothing that's going to happen. And then like I get there and that day there's an active shooter warning.
Oh.
And it was basically a guy who would, like, threaten to, like, break in or whatever, but they still, as security, they were still going to have us be there. But basically what they told us was, if he rolls up, just hit the gate thing, let him in, and then call on your radio that he's inside.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Do you think people would be surprised, say, if we wrote essays about working in a library? Do you think people would be surprised about what those essays might contain?
I think people would be very surprised. Yes. 'Cause we have people that work here that have said that I had no idea that working at a public library was going to be like this. Like, I had just no idea. And they are blown away by the kinds of things and the kinds of interactions that we have on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. We should be collecting these, especially from the people that have been working here
for a long time.
For a long time, yeah. That'd be a good book.
Yeah. No, when I was hired, people made all kinds of comments like, oh, my grandma was like, that's such a perfect job. You'll just get to read all day.
Yeah.
People have a very, like, I don't know, 1950s movie idea of what librarians, they just sit there at the desk and turn the pages, and every once in a while they're like, shh.
Right.
Yeah, it's very romanticized. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Like, all you do is do reader's advisory and then read at the desk, and that's it.
That's
it. It's great.
Do you guys remember in It's a Wonderful Life?
Yes, yes. Okay,
we always refer, like, Becky and I will always refer to this in A Wonderful Life when
Mary, he's
come back. George Bailey's come back to this alternate world where he doesn't exist. And where is his sweetheart? She's at the library.
Yeah, but they say it. She's working at the library.
He's like, the library? Not the library?
Yeah.
No, you know, she's like an old, because she's like an old maid, because he doesn't exist. She's working at the library.
And she's got the glasses. It's a spinster.
What a sad fate, you know. Yeah. What a sad
what
fate.
What could be worse?
I usually ask, and I forgot. So what did you guys read to prepare for today? Did you, you know, it sounds like Joe and I had read a lot of stuff in the past, but what did you guys read?
I started with The Best of Me. Figured that going with, like, his collections of, you know, quote, best works, unquote, would be a good start. And I wanted to also read his most recent Happy-Go-Lucky, but I didn't end up getting the chance to finish The Best of Me, so I didn't get to Happy-Go-Lucky. Although, now that I've discovered David Sedaris, in part because of the podcast, I'm very interested in continuing to read more of his work. I very much like him, and I think I'm going to go through his entire catalog at this point. I also listened to a few interviews on YouTube where he talks to, like, different talk show hosts and such, and just to kind of get an idea of the kind of person he is and, like, the way he speaks. So those were pretty informative, too.
Mm-hmm. I did the same thing. I was listening to interviews on YouTube and NPR, and then I don't know. I think I read Holidays on Ice, but I've mostly listened to him because he's so good. The audio versions are so good. He's so good at reading his own work. And so I re-listened to Me Talk Pretty One Day.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I guess that's a good recommendation for our listeners who we know are audio people, is those audiobooks are fantastic. I kind of, like, was pecking around here and there, and I eventually landed on I was reading them in reverse order. So I read Happy-Go-Lucky, and then I read Calypso, and then I started rereading Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, and kind of poked around other stuff here and there. I read a little bit from The Best of Me.
Did you listen to interviews, or did you listen to anything on audiobook, or was it all just you just read?
I did some listening too, and I often have listened to his stuff and watched readings and stuff. I'll say it was a really pleasurable, like, we could read all kinds of stuff for work, right? And so, like, some of the stuff we'll read for Adult Book Club is kind of heavy. It was like candy, like going through the David Sedaris. It was really nice. There have been some episodes, I won't say which ones, on this podcast where it's like, oh, I have to read that thing. This was not like that. It's and you know, not a lot of stuff makes me laugh out loud while I'm reading, but there was a lot of me laughing from the other room and Becky being like, what is it? What? You know, because, yeah, really, really funny.
Of the works that he's written, and, like, the styles of essays that he's written, do you find that you prefer the ones that focus more on his personal life or the ones that are more fictionalized?
I love the personal life ones. I love getting to know all his family members and the dynamics and how his reflections change over the years. Those are my favorite. I feel like, you know, they're part of my family, or that I've really gotten to know them. I'm sure that's not true. I think he said that whenever he writes something about his family, he clears it with them first, and he always says that they find it funny too, so they know that.
Which is amazing, considering some of what he writes.
Yeah, I know. It's oversharing sometimes, but I do love that personal aspect.
I like the essays too. I had trouble when I was going back trying to read the fiction pieces he would do, and I think maybe I would have an easier time listening to them. Because I think I remember hearing some of them, because those would be on This American Life a lot. Like, was it Chipmunk Meets Squirrel or Chipmunk Seeks Squirrel, and some of the like animal allegories he was doing for a while. But the essays are my favorite. And it seems like he's moved toward more of that. Like these last few are all essays.
I also learned that him and Amy have written a couple plays, which I didn't know. So that would be interesting to read those or to see those performed.
Yeah. That would be cool.
I definitely liked both, but I found myself drawn more toward the fiction.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I did like learning about his family, and I felt, especially the ones with his dad, those are just hilarious to me. But I talked about the Thaddeus, whatever, like the play reviewer, like that one really sticks in my mind. And then he wrote this one about this guy named Greg or something, where he's like dealing with like a homophobic world. Oh, and that one was so funny.
I do remember that one. Yeah.
It's basically like a blogger, or like he writes like a newsletter, and he just talks about all these homophobic things that he encounters in his life. And it's basically just him being just a jerk and having no self-awareness. And then just saying that every single thing that happens to him is the result of someone being homophobic toward him. Like it has nothing to do with his terrible personality or the way he treats
it all on homophobia.
Right.
Have you guys ever heard him sing Ella Fitzgerald? It's so good.
Yeah. Did you listen to that? Have you heard that at all?
No, I haven't.
He sings Jingles in the voice of Ella Fitzgerald. Is that in Holidays on Ice that he does that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a talent that he cultivated.
And also, I think in Me Talk Pretty One Day, because he's talking about his dad was a big jazz lover.
Yeah.
And he wanted all his kids to have music lessons. I think his dad had this dream of having a family jazz band or something. And he talks about he did guitar, and his music teacher was a little person. And he was saying, well, I don't really like, playing this guitar, but he was excited to have this music teacher hear him sing like Ella Fitzgerald. And so he does a little bit in the audio version. And I guess the music teacher was disgusted, and he was real hurt by that. He thought that they could have a real bond.
I think it's amazing how many stories he can pull out of his life. And I don't know whether that's just because he's one of those people that was just given of an interesting life, dealt that hand, or whether he's just so good at remembering the little details and being able to extrapolate that. And he's just such a talented writer that he can make even the most mundane thing interesting and beautifully written.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. Obviously, he does have some good material, but like I think people overestimate that. You know, because there's lots of people with all kinds of experiences and crazy lives who can't or aren't inclined to, like, write about them.
Well, he also kept a diary all his life, didn't he? Or a journal?
Yeah, he keeps a journal. Yeah. Which he started publishing bits of that now, too. So that's a whole other subgenre of his stuff, are these books of diary entries that he started publishing. A Carnival of Snackery and some of those ones.
In Me Talk Pretty One Day, he talks about he taught Impressionist art in college, and just what a sham that was, at least on his side. He said he would do these nap on a table, and that was his art, and making all these people watch him do that. And about like all the drug use he was doing at that time.
I remember that one. There's a few scenes in that, but I don't think I can talk about them here.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I don't know what our rating is on this podcast.
Whatever we
want it to be.
You just slap a content warning on it before you read it, if you listen to it past that point, it's on you.
This is the explicit, unbleeped version.
So I'm just going to read a couple of poems from Dog Days, which was in The Best of Me. Pepper, Spot, and Leopold were sent by God, so I've been told, in hopes we might all comprehend that every dog is man's best friend. Hail, hyperactive Myrtle, owned by folks who were infertile. Her owners boast as she runs wild, she's not a spaniel, she's our child. Rags the Shatwell's Irish setter, doubles as a paper shredder. His lunch was bills and last year's taxes, followed by a dozen faxes. Kimmy, once considered ruthless, lies in her basket, bald and toothless. Her youth's long spent, so now she passes all her time releasing gases. I wanted to talk about one of the other essays I read in Best of Me real quick. So there's this one about a bear whose mom, actually stepmom, dies very suddenly. And this bear, this self-absorbed bear, walks around telling everyone how tragic it is, and she just does it for the attention. And she realizes that she can get things out of it, like food and shelter. But then, you know, of course, that sympathy well runs dry because it's a year later and she's still telling this tale. And everyone else is like, well, you know, our parents are dead. Like, get over it. And she has to go help this other bear who has an injured paw, like, go dig a hole. And she's just so self-absorbed that she just completely forgets and blows it off. And it's just like, I'm not going to do that. And she finds this bear that is in a circus and is basically like a performer. And she's talking to him. And what ends up happening is she ends up getting captured by these circus performers. And she becomes the new performing bear. And the end of it is her teeth get busted out and she has to wear this muzzle. And she's just telling the story over and over again to every crowd that she performs in front of. And she imagines in her head that they're all very sympathetic to her plight of her losing her mother.
Wow.
I don't know why. I just like that story so much.
There's a little allegory there for David Sedaris, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's just so many good ones to choose from.
Yeah, there are. There are. I like his mom a lot, too, in the essays. She's, and like I said, she's usually kind of in memory, you know, because she died in the 90s. But she was like the one who maybe understood him more.
For sure.
I think he said in one interview that if his mom could have bought a kit to make your kid a homosexual, that she would have, like, she was just all just so supportive and positive about that aspect of his life.
I thought it was funny where there was this part where they finally get snow in the place that they've been living,
mm-hmm.
and his mom sends all the kids out, and they want to go inside at a certain point, but she just making them stay outside so she can enjoy the peace and quiet of a house by herself.
Oh, and, man.
Yeah. And then they're like, you know what would really upset her is if one of us, like, got hit by a car. And so, like, one of the kids, and I think it might have been Tiffany, but just goes and lays in the road.
Yeah.
And, like convince her to just lay in the road. No one was harmed, but.
Happy-go-lucky is a little bit, like, I feel like a little bit sadder. I mean, it's still really funny, but he's dwelled a lot on, like, Tiffany's suicide and, like, some of the things that they would go years without talking. And she would, like, feud with different, you know, like, be allied to one sibling and feud with another one, and had some accusations of abuse against their dad that he kind of, like, talks about. And then also the C-section is destroyed by a hurricane. There's an essay about that. But they ended up buying, like, the place next door, which is, like, this big pink house while they were working on the C-section. But at one point, like, Hugh, there's just really there's like some really tender moments in this book. Hugh, who's kind of like the noble partner, you know, like David's like kind of more high strung, and Hugh is always like the one who knows how to do everything, breaks down crying, you know, after that house has been destroyed and David has to comfort him. But then they buy this pink one next door and they're trying to come up with a name for it because the C-section has been destroyed. And I don't know if they ever land on one, but Canker Shores was one of the suggestions. And I love those later essays. His dad will, like, come, and he'll hear things like that. And he'll be like, you can't call a house that. And they'll be like, yes, I can. Like, and David will talk about all these weird things he wants to do with the house. And his dad is just like,
I wonder if he bought a beach house because he has this memory in The Best of Me where, like, they were almost going to buy a beach house. They had talked about it and they were going to pull the trigger. And then it didn't happen. And so he'd already, like, told everyone, started getting people ready to do sleepovers at this beach house.
Oh, yeah.
And he talked about the process of naming it, and everybody had, like, a different name picked out, and his was they were going to have a sign of like the silhouette of a boat, and it was going to be called the Ship Shape.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He has an essay, The Ship Shape. Yeah. Well, and he talks about, too, like when he spends a lot of time, they spent, and I think as the books go on, more and more time there, they would go there when he was a kid, like teenagers, and rent a place
right.
when his mom was still alive. And he talks in one of the essays, this really beautiful scene, about like that was when they were all, nobody had died yet. Mm-hmm. Everybody was all potential, you know. They would go to that area, Emerald Island, Isle, North Carolina. And part of wanting to get the beach house was to like try to recreate that. Half of the beach house is his. There's half where he just lets people do what they want, and then half where he is like, gets the final veto on all decorating and all all everything, which is pretty weird decorating, I think, knowing David Sedaris. But are you guys both on the podcast next month? I don't remember. Judy Blume is our next author.
I don't know.
I think I probably will
We'll
be.
Find out, I guess, if we're on it or not. So next month we will be reading Judy Blume. Do you guys have any final parting thoughts on David Sedaris or anything else you wanted to talk about?
I just wanted to say that during the interviews, it's interesting to me how people are funny in different ways. Mm-hmm. And there are some people that when they're like trying to land a joke or something, they're very performative and like expressive. And they, you know, to get that joke out, they really have to put on this like stage persona. And with David Sedaris, he's so witty and there's such an ease about him that he can say the funniest things and his delivery can be so deadpan or it can be so relaxed mm-hmm. and you still get the same effect. Mm-hmm. There's an ease about it that I don't think I've seen often.
Yeah, that reminds me, he was in one interview talking about when he first started to write. He said he was picking fruit in Oregon at one point in his life, and he had little shout out to libraries. He had gotten himself a library card at the local public library and started to check out all these books that he should have read when he was in high school and college, like, you know, all the well-known great masterpieces of the time. And he would write, and then he would think this is pretty good. And then he would read a published book and think, oh, no, I'm not good yet. But he said that's the advice that he has to young writers. Just keep reading books. And compare your work. It, you know, is this readable? Like these already published books are readable. I thought that was
interesting.
Yeah.
Another thing about him that I think is unusual is, so he does this rigorous touring schedule every year. He works out his essays. Like he'll write essays. But then he works them out and tweaks them, performing them.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like stand-up comedians
sure.
do with jokes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and he did that at the one that Becky and I went to. Yeah, he'll try it out and he'll kind of notice areas where the, you know, interest dips or, oh, this got a big laugh or this got no laugh at all, which I think is interesting. Kind of hybrid between, there's lots of humorists who are not like that at all, public performers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, thank you guys for coming on. Thank you everybody for listening. Go read some David Sedaris. And join the summer reading program while you're doing it. We know you're out there reading. This has been Your Shelf.
Or Mine.
Or Mine.
I'm Austin.
I'm Jacob.
I'm Joe.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Support for Your Shelf or Mine comes from the Friends of the Longview Public Library, the Longview Library Foundation, and listeners like you. Your Shelf or Mine jingle is written and performed by Megan McKeldery from A Song for You. Find Megan online at ReverbNation.com/Megan McKeldery. That's MEAGHANMCELDERRY. ReverbNation.com/Megan McKeldery.